This is a story about the end of life, about choosing what's right for you and what really matters. Ultimately, this is about a very uncomfortable question. How do you want to die? 80% of Americans say that they would prefer to die at home, but most of us end up dying in hospitals or nursing homes hooked to machines. A pilot program in Philadelphia provides patients the care they want when living with a life-threatening illness and where they want it, at home. I followed one patient enrolled in this program starting last summer on an August morning. Oncology nurse practitioner Megan Coleman has her coffee, her phone, and she's headed to Collegeville.
Head southeast on Monument Road.
She's on her way to visit Joanna Little, a 40-year-old cancer patient who has chosen to transition into a different kind of care.
It means that she's going not to get treatment any further and that she's going to be comfortable and her needs will be met.
Coleman is working for a project called CLAIM. It stands for Comprehensive Longitudinal Advanced Illness Management. It's a UPenn pilot program providing extensive care for cancer patients who are either dying or facing very serious illness. They work with patients who qualify for home care, meaning they are so sick they are having trouble getting around. As part of the program, patients have nurses who visit them at home, and that's what Megan Coleman is doing today.
I'm just getting off exit 31 now, so we should be there shortly.
She hasn't met Joanna Little yet. Little's regular nurse is not in today, but Coleman knows a lot about her patient's wishes.
She wants her children by her side to be there, for them to be together, and for her not to be on a continual cycle of hope and chemotherapy not working, hope, chemotherapy not working.
We arrive at Little's house a few minutes later. It's a spacious home with a beautiful yard and comfy couches. Pictures of Little's husband, Garth, and their four children cover most walls. Their youngest son is in elementary school, their oldest daughter in college. The living room floor is crisscrossed with clear tubes tethered to oxygen tanks in another room. Little looks pale. A tube pushes oxygen into her nose. She and Coleman strike up an easy conversation, chatting like old friends. Little was diagnosed with stage 4 rectal cancer in 2008. When it was discovered, the cancer had already spread to her lungs. She enrolled with Coleman's program in May of 2013.
I would love it if you could tell me about your transition, because I just wasn't part of that at that time.
I have been fighting cancer for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And it's been an uphill battle. I mean, it's been horrible. Anything that could go wrong went wrong. I'm allergic to 3 chemotherapies. It has just not been an easy 5 years. But I fought through everything. Mm-hmm. And that's just who I am. I'm a fighter. I don't give up easy at all.
But by early 2013, Little said she was tired of the constant hospitalizations. She was run down and emotionally drained. She missed her home, home-cooked food. She enrolled with the CLAIM program to access more comprehensive care.
So I came home and Rosie showed up and it was like love at first sight.
Yeah. Rosie is Joanna Little's regular visiting nurse. Little says some of her friends and family were not happy with her decision.
That's it, you're dying. Death wish has been signed, you know. Death is imminent. And for me, that's the dumbest. Like, you don't tell me that.
That thinking that even considering the end means it's over is a misconception that Dr. David Casaret faces a lot. He's in charge of hospice and palliative care for Penn Medicine and is heading the pilot program Little is enrolled in. Here's how he distinguishes what the program provides from hospice care.
Palliative care is an extra layer of support that goes on and over the other care that patients get when they're facing serious, often life-limiting illnesses. It includes things like pain and symptom management, emotional and spiritual support, counseling about goals and prognosis, but more broadly, it's tying everything together, making sure all the physicians and other healthcare providers are talking to each other.
Caseret says this kind of care can go hand in hand with active treatment, or it can help shepherd a patient in the last weeks of life. His program is funded with over $4 million from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and his team is investigating whether having this kind of wraparound care gives patients better quality of life and saves money because of reduced hospitalizations.
We provide the eyes and the ears when we go out to see a patient in the home.
All patients in the program have a care team in addition to their regular oncologists and primary care doctors. They can call a hotline at any time, and if they are in crisis, a nurse will come to their home.
We try to relay what we see and what we hear to the patient's healthcare providers so everybody's on the same page. We don't take over the care.
The patients in the program are very sick, but not all are dying. Some are still in active treatment for their cancer, while some are considering transitioning into hospice care. Caseret says sometimes his care teams facilitate a long overdue conversation.
A common story I hear all the time is that a patient really doesn't want another round of chemotherapy, but doesn't want to tell his doctor that because he doesn't want his doctor to think he's giving up or that he doesn't think his doctor can pull him through. And then on the other side of the coin, the doctor also doesn't think that another round of chemotherapy will benefit that patient, but she doesn't want to tell the patient that because she doesn't want the patient to think that she's giving up on him. So you have a physician and a patient, neither of whom wants more chemotherapy, neither of whom thinks it will help, but they're both playing the game.
Patients typically spend several months in the CLAIM program. Jamie Roberts is a clinical social worker who cares for patients enrolled. She says getting involved with families for a longer period of time allows her to better care for their needs in crisis situations.
We've got to know people over a period of time, too, and love them in a really meaningful way so that they know we care. And when you have that kind of closeness with the family, then there's a trust that develops.
Joanna Little says having this kind of care has made her feel more in charge.
I didn't know. Nobody gave me the manual on how to be a cancer patient. But at some point, you have to start taking control of your own health. I plan on living. Now I'm exhausted and I have to rest and relax. But, you know, I want to be here for my kids. I want to be here for my husband and for my family.
What do you want? That question enters the conversation early on, says oncology nurse Megan Coleman. Care teams discuss goals of care with patients, the trade-off between chemotherapy, side effects, time lost, time gained. On her way back from Little's house, Coleman contemplates the choices her patient has made.
And I think that she sees the value of living her life. Like, I'm not sure that everybody gets that.
During a visit in October, Joanna Little is in bed. Her breathing seems a little bit more labored. Her mother is now staying with the family, but she's upbeat and happy. She has a new puppy, and her nurse has just delivered her medications.
Didn't she tell you I'm the Energizer Bunny now?
No, you didn't tell me that.
My name is Rosie Winkler, and I am Joanna's home nurse. I help with Joanna's med management. I pretty much just ask her general health questions, review all her systems.
Little was only in the hospital one time since the summer, and she had just managed to drop her daughter off at college. Palliative care expert David Caseret says so far he has enrolled over 300 patients in this pilot program. The goal is 1,600. He says what he's learned so far is that this program is filling a huge gap in care. Patients who are very sick but not at the very end of life often experience a myriad of poorly managed symptoms: pain, nausea, depression, anxiety. They end up in the hospital because of a fever or a pain flare-up. They receive treatments they don't want or need. He hopes that providing patients with comprehensive palliative care could not only save money, but could mean that a patient's journey through illness or toward the end of life becomes easier, better planned, and managed.
It can be something that's so positive, you know, if you just allow them to help you out.
Joanna Little died in November of 2013 in her home, surrounded by her family. I recently talked to a friend who had been working on his advanced medical directive. That's the paperwork you fill out where you explain how you want to be cared for at the end of life. And he said, you know, when I was answering all those questions about feeding tubes and resuscitation efforts, I really wanted to have a none of the above option. Most Americans don't have an advanced directive, but research finds that they still want their wishes respected. Marketplace healthcare reporter Dan Gorenstein recently investigated whether doctors are any better prepared than the rest of us when it comes to the end of life, and he joins us now. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Maiken.
Dan, tell me about the premise of your reporting.
Well, right, as you mentioned, Maiken, I mean, a lot of Americans don't die well. Many people don't die in their homes where they want to be. They end up dying in nursing homes or in the hospital. And so, you know, really, we wanted to look at what is driving this problem and do doctors, in fact, do it any differently. I ended up interviewing three different doctors who had were in various stages of serious illness. Some were dying, some were just given serious diagnoses. And I think the premise really of the story that we did at Marketplace was, do doctors have a better sense of where they are?
And do they?
Well, statistically, there's no indication that they do. They are, though, better planners. There's one report out from that followed Johns Hopkins doctors that showed they were more likely to file advanced directives. But really, the advantage that doctors have, obviously, is that they live life and death all the time in their jobs, and they really understand medicine and the limitations of medicine in a way that lay people can't.
Do you think doctors do make different choices than the rest of us?
It depends. You know, I think it's really important to point out that doctors are human beings too. And lots of them, just like us, are scared about dying. And some doctors actually end up, you know, choosing this profession because they don't want to die. And I think that, you know, I did talk with this one oncologist in North Carolina, Ken Zeitler, and he was really sort of emotionally torn. He has a brain tumor. He's afraid of losing his ability to walk and move and bike and all of these different things. But he wasn't able to really articulate that to his family. He had a procedure done, a simple biopsy, that resulted in half of his body being paralyzed. And he'd never really communicated these deep fears. And here's a doctor who's been around this stuff for years and years. But it really underscores how difficult it is, even for doctors, to talk about this.
As much as they'll cry about me every bar mitzvah and every wedding, I don't want to be there if I'm just completely miserable. I've seen that. I don't need that.
Are there things that all of us could do about this issue of end-of-life care, not talking about death, doctors, non-doctors, everybody?
So I interviewed one of the sort of grandfathers of palliative care for this story, Dr. Andrew Billings. And Dr. Andrew Billings said to me, look, doctors are the ones who have to be responsible. Doctors need to figure out and start these conversations. But you have to think about this fact that doctors are really bad at giving prognoses. They're accurate just like 20% of the time. And the more a doctor knows the patient, the more optimistic the doctor is, because the doctor wants the patient to live too. And Dr. Billings, while he's a palliative care expert, he also has been given a very serious diagnosis and, you know, could be looking at the end of his life. And as he's been thinking about this, this is what he said to me about how doctors should handle the situation.
I think they need to give a prognosis, which can be very simple, like, you know, you have a very serious illness, and I wonder if you've thought about it getting worse. In other words, you don't need to go right to your dead ducky. Don't buy any green bananas.
I mean, I love that guy. He's got a sense of humor right now.
So thinking about all the conversations you had with doctors, the time you spend, do doctors have something to teach us?
I think they do. I mean, it was a real honor to sit and spend hours and hours with these three physicians all in various stages of potentially dying. The biggest thing that I learned, and this came from Dr. Elizabeth McKinley, who's from Cleveland, and she's actually since passed away, is that you have to be brave and you have to be courageous and you have to acknowledge that this is where I am.
I think allowing death to be at the front door allows us to talk more about life in reality, because I think that's what we're talking about. I think we're talking about how to maximize a good life.
Dr. McKinley ultimately decided, I'm not going to do more chemo because it's going to hollow me out and I'm not going to be able to spend the final months with my children in the way that I want. So she ultimately chose quality of life over quantity of life. And not all doctors do that, but they certainly seemingly have a leg up from the rest of us when it comes to that.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Mikan.
Dan Gorenstein is the healthcare reporter for Marketplace. Coming up, an old stately building near Philadelphia's airport tells the story of a crisis that almost wiped out the entire city.
A visitor to the city who might have had the courage to enter at that time would have found a very, very odd environment. First of all, they would notice that the streets were devoid of a lot of people. Because if you could get out of town, you got out of town.
That's coming up on The Pulse.